to say something about the British psychotherapist Donald Winnicott, born at the end of the 19th century, died in 1971, lived and worked here in London. He is brilliant, not only psychotherapeutically, but also for what he might have to say about wider discussions going on now to do with how consciousness is evolving, the challenges which we face in the modern world. He also is, in my opinion, in a way far better than Freud. Freud unleashed psychotherapy, but in a way his kind of literary genius still captures the imagination far too much. And Winnicott took a lot of Freudian ideas on, gave them a twist or a reformulation, which makes much, much better sense now, I think. He also provides quite a good entree into Jung. He was a bit wary of Jung in life, but actually heard Jung speak. And a lot of his ideas are said in simpler form that then give you a way to access what Jung was saying in sometimes more symbolic or mystical ways. And then finally, he brings together a developmental sense of ourselves, so how we grow as individuals through various stages and processes, how that works, but also has an integral sense of ourselves as well, even a sense of how we connect with what's transcendent. And so bringing those two aspects together can be really useful as well. So I'll start with the developmental side. Perhaps his most famous comment that he made when he was giving broadcasts actually in the UK during the 1950s was the comment, "There's no such thing as a baby." And he was a psychotherapist who worked a lot with mothers and children. And he noticed that babies are immensely vulnerable, to state the obvious, but that means they need what he called a facilitating environment in order to grow. They need a person or people around them who are able to put to one side their own concerns, their own preoccupations, at least to some degree, in order to facilitate and adapt to what's going on for the child. You see this the minute you observe a mother and a child or a father and a child, the way that the child, say, will be crying and the parent will try not so much to stop the crying, that can happen at times, but more generally to try and sort of be alongside the crying so the crying can work its way out and the child can find the path back to feeling calm, happy, collected. This is a key developmental process, Winnicott argued, and because it's when we have that facilitating environment who can help us that we gain a sense of ourselves, that we feel is safe and trustworthy. Another little example he gives at one point is asking about how you might help a child complete a jigsaw. And if you just said to the child, "Get on with it yourself," that might upset them. If you put every piece into the jigsaw yourself for the child, and that too would upset them. But if you go, "Oh, look, you know, what's this piece here? It's got blue. I wonder where that fits." Sort of facilitate the child being able to put the jigsaw together. Then he thought that is the way to help a child develop, to put together the pieces of life, you might say. He talked about what happens when things go wrong, and a key word for him there is impingements. This is when things come in from the outside into the child's world that hinder that facilitation, that stop it. And in a way, what happens there is the child may have to adapt to the person who's supposed to be adapting to it, rather than the other way around. But of course, it hasn't got the resources to do that. It can't understand the adult world. It's at moments like this in his work that you get tiny glimpses of how utterly devastating abuse is, for example, because abuse asks the child to behave like an adult, to accommodate the adult, when the child can't begin to comprehend what that's about. And so it just leaves the child with a shattered sense of self and full of fear and darkness that can then take many, many years to recover. So impingements is a key word for him when things go wrong. He thought that when things go well enough, though, and this is a key idea for him, well enough, then the child moves through various stages. But what's interesting about this is that it must be well enough and not perfect. The good enough parent is what's required, he thought. Because whilst the child mustn't suffer too many impingements, it must also have the chance to struggle. the chance to make mistakes, the chance even to feel stressed at times, because it's in that process that the self gains a sense of itself and it doesn't just rely on the other all the time. The child that has a sort of perfect parent is actually likely to suffer from narcissistic problems later on, and because it hasn't had to struggle with itself. He had quite a nice little formula that captures the sort of sense of balance here. He talked about X plus Y plus Z. And X is normal everyday stress, a bit of stress that happens and you kind of recover. Y is the kind of stress where you don't immediately recover. It does leave you floundering to some degree. And yet, either from a facilitating environment, help from someone else, or from resources within yourself, you manage to work out how to overcome the stress, how to overcome the difficulty, and actually find that you grow in the process. So that's a kind of growing kind of stress rather than just an automatic recovery kind of stress. But then there's also Z, and Z is when it goes on for too long and the child or the person is left struggling for too long, unable to deal with the situation, unable to have a mind about it. And then that leaves trauma, which hasn't been resolved, hasn't been recovered from, and will take something further down the line in order to move it, as it were, into the Y zone and then into the X zone. So X plus Y plus Z. X happens every day, Y happens when we grow, Z too much, too long time, without support, without a facilitating environment, and that can lead to trauma. Now, he thought that in the Y process, the Y stage, the child will tend to go through what he called stages of Ruth, which was his sort of contraction of ruthless, and then stages of concern. What he meant by stages of Ruth was when the child demands attention, when it demands what it needs, food, security, comfort, emotional support, contact with the parent. And the ruthlessness of that, again, will be experienced by many parents who feel often quite tyrannized by their child, and they organize their whole life around it. But it's necessary because of the vulnerability of the child in order that the parent can adapt to it, but mustn't be too perfect. Doesn't just give in to the ruthlessness all the time, otherwise the child never gains the sense of itself. But if that goes well enough, then it moves on to the stage of concern, by which he meant when the child begins to get a sense that there is another for whom it has concern. It's not just that people are concerned for it, but it too has concern. And so the stage of concern leads to the birth of love, but also guilt and anxiety as well. There's always this kind of mix in Winnicott, always this developmental sense that if you can move through the difficult stages, then you can grow more and more into relationships with others, as well as relationship with yourself. And a key moment comes, he thought, when the child in the stage of concern is also able to what he called use the other, use the object. And by that he meant that with love, with compassion for the other person, with the sense of them as another person, you know, integral unto themselves, you can nonetheless use them to work out something for yourself. So a good argument is like this. In a good argument, it's not just that two people agree with each other, but they may test each other to some degree, but that in order that a new position can emerge, a kind of spiral upwards, a virtuous circle is created. And so the two are using each other in order to grow. A good tennis match is like this, for example. You know, the real greats will say that they needed their long-lasting standing opponent in order to make their own game better. They really, you know, go for it, really try and beat the other person, and yet at the same time secretly need the other person not to collapse too soon. They're able to use each other's games in order to raise their own game. And so this is quite a subtle thing that goes on in mature relationships. When there is love there, there is that sense of concern, but there's also that sense of camaraderie, perhaps, but also working together to tease something out, not being afraid of critiquing, not being afraid of receiving critique, not being afraid of, long periods of struggle even, a bit like the long tennis match. But that is a crucial part of mature development, as opposed to the younger childish development, when the facilitating environment just supports and adapts. this is also really interesting because in Winnicott you have this powerful sense that you know, we find ourselves in relation to others. Remember, there's no such thing as a baby. There is that mutuality which is key to who we are as human. But at the same time, there's a kind of third position which must also be able to move beyond just that dependence with another person. He called it interdependence. When, in a way, you can think of it as being able to use both the dependence upon another's person, another person, their resources, independence that can use your own resources that are fostered inside you, to move to interdependence when you can draw on both sides, and both the sense that you can rely on someone else, but also rely on yourself in order to grow into a fuller maturity. So use of the object and interdependence in a way is the kind of full flourishing of the capacity to develop in that side of his thought. Now, therapeutically, he's a great favourite because he has wonderful phrases that capture a lot of what the therapeutic task is about. A key one is the notion of fear of breakdown. And he argued that whilst the symptoms and the immediate causes can be very varied that lead someone to seek some therapy, to feel they need this facilitating environment, this help once more, he argued that often it's connected to our very earliest experience, and that what happens subsequently just triggers or connects with that earlier experience. And he felt that growing up tends to be really quite a traumatic experience. Hopefully it's in the X plus Y zone, not in the Z zone. But nonetheless, even when it's in the X plus Y zone, it can leave a sense that you're at risk of breakdown. And he argued that's because a breakdown has happened already. Even birth itself, he thought, must be experienced as some sort of breakdown, that huge wrench from the perfect, almost facilitating environment in the womb to the world. And so this kind of memory hangs around. It hangs around more in the body at this early stage, in the feelings of the body in particular, because it's in this phase of life before we really remember things. Often what can happen that when people become anxious later in life, it's as if their unconscious mind is remembering the earlier breakdown and thinking it's going to happen again, so that the person becomes too vigilant in life and worries constantly they're about to be attacked, they're about to be in the Z zone once more and break down again, when really what's happening is that they're remembering the old breakdown and not being able to be free from it. So what can happen in a therapy is that over time, and you know, it may well take some time because these things have become part of who we are to some large degree, but over time, the person may gain a sort of 3D sense of themselves. They may realise that what they experience in the moment isn't necessarily fully happening in the moment, but it's bringing back the past into the present, confusing it up, which makes the sense of it being overwhelming and not being able to think about it, have a mind about it. But the good side is that this sense of fear of breakdown, when it's untangled, when it starts to kind of become a bit more spacious inside, does give you a sense of moving through time, does give you a sense of how your sense of yourself is connected with all the older parts of yourself. So again, strangely with Winnicott, the difficulty is actually the path to the awakening, to certainly the expansion of the sense of self. Because even if you have had a difficult childhood and things have occurred which maybe you don't even remember from the earliest parts of your life, as you begin to get a sense that they belong in the past, then you also have a sense that there's a present that's different now. And of course, then that makes for the possibility of a new future too. So actually, the therapeutic process isn't just about healing things, even accommodating yourself to what happened before, but can itself then become the beginnings of a new future with an expansion of the sense of yourself. As it were, your inner life has a richness and a depth, as well as a sense of difficulty and darkness and light and hope as well, that you had never had sort of any sense of before you dealt with this fear of breakdown. So therapeutically, he's very useful, I think, too, because he gives this sense not just of healing old problems, but also stepping into a new future as well. He has that sense of 3D sense of self, you might say. Now, so this leads sort of from the developmental side of him into the more integral or transcendent even side of him. He thought that Another really important thing which people do to develop is use what he calls transitional objects. These are things in life. They might begin with a favourite toy. They might then in later life become an image. They might become a person. They might become rituals and religions that you do. And these are elements of life that, he said, you don't question. You just accept them. You take them at face value. And again, you know, the parent with a child that has a transitional object, you know, like a favourite bit of rag, say, if the parent interferes with that rag, say, says something like, look, I think it needs a wash, that does something to the child which threatens the transitional object. It says, look, this isn't a kind of object you're projecting your fantasies onto, your imagination onto, drawing succour and support from. It says it's just a bit of rag and it needs a clean. And that can be really upsetting for the child because it interrupts, it impinges upon this use of the transitional object to feel safe and so be able to step more widely into the world. You know, similarly, with religious rituals or religious symbols, for example, you need to question them carefully, because if you just question them to attack or to pretend that, say, the bread and wine of the Eucharist is just bread and wine, that threatens the symbol and it threatens its ability to transmit more than just itself. It ceases being a transitional object. And so religious people will resist that. But on the other hand, if they treat it just as a sort of fully realised object that hasn't got anything new to transmit to them, then it stops being transitional as well. So there's this balance in religious systems and in other rituals and other symbols that we use between trusting it and in a way not questioning it, but also inquiring into it in order that more can come through. There's some of the sophistication in Winnicott, which is really powerful once you get a feel for it. He called a lot of this play, and again has this sort of nice reformulation of putting it, that play is something that adults do when they're able, and children practice doing in order to become adults. So it's not that children play, it's actually that adults play and children practice at playing. And play for him, again, is about existing at this kind of border between what we know and what we don't know, between the conscious parts of ourselves that we have trust in, find reliable, and the unconscious, more shadowy parts of ourselves that we want to explore. And play enables us to hover at that edge to see what more might come through. So play, when it goes well, is expansive, but it mustn't be too destructive. You know, so think of something like a horror movie. He would wonder whether a horror movie, brilliantly pitched, enables us to have to hang at the edge of what we're not frightened of and what we are frightened of, in order that we can become more familiar with that darkness and see whether it changes through the play. So play has this particular quality for him as well. And it also involves another really key element for him, which he very much transforms from Freud, in fact, which is the notion of fantasy. And what Winnicott realised was that Freud had been wrong about our inner fantasies. Freud had thought that all our inner fantasies, from the most trivial to the most elaborate, like, say, whole religious systems, they are the projections of an anxious self onto the world around us, which in itself is pitiless and uncaring and mechanical, doesn't live at all. But through our projections, we try and make an accommodation with that pitiless, uncaring world around us. And so we build, rich pictures of the imagination, rich systems of thought based on the imagination that aren't in themselves true, but serve us by helping us to accommodate ourselves to what is ultimately a kind of no man's land out there. Now, Winnicott thought this can't be right, because otherwise we'd all be living in our castles in the sky. No doubt we do that sometimes. But on the whole, we do manage to communicate. These things do last. They don't, as it were, just constantly fall, crash down, which you'd expect if they were just self-sustaining, self-built. They seem to have more robustness and resilience than that. And Winnicott also noticed that they don't just serve to prop up our sense of self, but they also serve to open us onto reality more. He's in the romantic tradition here, where the idea was that the imagination is actually truth-bearing. It can tell us something about reality. So it's not just that we project onto reality, but the reality inspires us back. when we use our fantasies and discern them in the right way. So he revises Freud's rather negative sense of fantasy here, and realises the imagination can actually communicate something of reality back to us. And it's a felt sense that is important in the discernment, ultimately. So the felt sense that, that makes me feel more at home in the world, or helps me see more of reality around me that doesn't just belong to me. I think Einstein was onto this when he makes his famous remark about how imagination takes us around the world, and it's prior to knowledge. Knowledge, if you like, is a bit of the imagination that you've pulled down and worked and done something tangibly with, like made it into an equation. But the premium and the prior facility that the scientist, and I think and the artist needs too, is imagination that can survey the world around, have this sense of what connects with the world around, and then draw that back into the self to expand the self once more, and also to expand the sense of reality too. So those are important things, transitional objects, particular rituals or things that we use to explore them and feel safe in the world around us, play, which has this particular quality of taking us to the edge of what's conscious for us, and then imagination too, which when it really works and really sings and really lasts, actually conveys more of reality back to us perhaps than we even project out to start with. He thought that another really important part of this kind of edge at which we must live and try and live well is the edge of our false selves. Another key phrase for him was the false self. And he argued that we always put on false selves. We need them to negotiate with reality. You know, when you're giving a talk, you put on a false self. When you go to work, you put on a false self. When you're a parent even, you put on a false self. And they're not necessarily bad. As long as they transmit what he called the true self. So the true self, he's much less clear about this in his work, but it's a sense of the wellspring of life. It's a sense of perhaps the spirit of things that can come through. I mean, if you are of a religious theistic mindset, it's the sense of the divine presence that can be incarnate in a particular life. But it needs to be incarnate in a particular life. It needs to be manifest in a particular form. And that's what a false self is. It's just a particular manifestation of the individual that's relating to the environment around them, connecting with the environment around them. And they work really well so long as they do channel or transmit this wellspring, this spirit of life, and this vitality, this spontaneity through the false self. False selves only become bad or tricky when they become disconnected from that wellspring of life, from the true self. And then they struggle because they're trying to draw on their own energy, trying to sustain themselves, and the individual will feel depressed or flattened, running out of energy, they'll have a breakdown, burnout, these kind of things happen. You know, it's why it happens perhaps at work after you've been at work for so many years. You've forgotten that it's supposed to be connecting you with a truer side of yourself that's connected to a sort of infinite ocean of energy. You've been relying too much on what you know and take to be the case. Stop playing at work, for example. And the false self starts to collapse in on itself. You maybe have a breakdown, or at least revise who you are at work, who you are in the world, in order to reconnect with this truer sense of self. Interestingly for Winnicott, the true self is not like the existential true self. It's not, as it were, the essence of who you are. And it's not also just your thrownness into life. It is a real part of, I think, a more expansive sense of self of the world around that Winnicott had. And I think this is one of the moments where he kind of can segue into Jung. Because whilst he wouldn't use an expression like the collective unconscious or even the collective conscious, there is a very powerful sense in him that certainly towards the end of his life, this was the direction he was moving in. He was a romantic. He did have this sense that our lives can't just be kind of isolated, lonely spots of light in a darkness, in the void, a sense that you get much more from Freud, for all Freud's brilliance, but that our light must ultimately be a reflection of a wider light. Our intelligence must be a reflection of a wider intelligence, and our play, our use of transitional objects, our development through ourselves, requiring facilitating environments, but also being able to use the world around us, is ultimately about connecting with this wider sense of self. Which is why I think he can speak so powerfully to those seeking the more transcendent or integral side of life, as well as just the purely therapeutic and developmental.